Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And this week we're joined by Colin Copeland and Tobias McNulty. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. Great to be here.
Thanks for coming on.
So we wanted to have you both on for a long time. Cactus is a pillar of the Django World consulting group. Tobias, you're also on the ops team for Django, which I've been roped into that last couple of years. I'd love to talk about that. But maybe first we could say, how did you both get into programming? And we'll go from there.
Yeah, I could take a swing at that first. I think into programming to start, I learned HTML early on and built some websites with a few friends and eventually met somebody online who just was like an hour away from me. And we became friends and decided that we or just kind of found out that we both had similar interests in wanting to build applications together and started a small Mac application company. It was tiny. We were just in high school, but we built a couple small applications and sold a couple, not very successful overall. But I think that's kind of where I got started. That was all in, I think, Real Basic. And
do you recall what type of applications they were? Was it things related to high school life or something for businesses if you sold them?
We did sell, we had a chat application with like a server and a client that was bought by a few businesses to use internally for chatting. And then the rest were fairly random. There was a bookmarking application and a small game we built. So it was definitely whatever we got kind of interested in, we wanted to build.
The chat app, that's like Slack, right? You could be Slack. Right, yeah. You're just ahead of the curve.
Very simple compared to Slack.
I think it's interesting what you said about meeting someone online because I think for people of our generation, so a couple decades in, I found that's pretty common in terms of people mm-hmm. who got into programming when they were younger. There wasn't a community, there weren't resources or necessarily easily accessible books. So usually it was going on IRC or some equivalent and finding someone. And then if you do happen, I just think in San Francisco, when I worked out there, basically everyone had that same experience. They were interested in it. No one around them was. And online, they sort of connected with people. So pre-Facebook and MySpace. But if you're able to do that, you're able to have this power and control over what you do. So I wonder if that's the same now. It seems like there's a lot more support and communities out there. So maybe that's not as common, but it feels very common to me for people a couple decades into things as we all are.
Yeah. 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 We both had similar like fan gaming websites and then found each other just through that network. And so it was a funny small world to realize that he just lived so close in the end and still keep in touch today, which is nice.
Just to continue, so then did you continue or did you ever formally study computer science or was it just completely on your own?
Yeah, I went to both Tobias and I went to a very small college, Earlham College, which in my class was, the CS department was very small. It was only about three of us. And so I did study computer science there. And one of the things I did really like about it was that all of the functions within the CS department were run by the students. So like the website and the networking, and they had these applied groups where we could all participate in the various activities that the department did. And one was that I was a part of was called the Hardware Interfacing Project, where we got to play around with these little embedded ARM Linux machines. And the project was to connect them to data monitoring devices for like we had wind monitoring devices and like temperature monitoring, and we would kind of test it within the local science department and then set up remote field devices so that they could record wind and temperature and send readings back to us over over a SIM card, over a data connection. And that's really where I got into Python programming. We did a lot of scripting with that, it was a lot easier to do than some of the C work that we were learning at that time. So I really fell in love with it then. and eventually what led me to Django there, because we had wanted a way to kind of view all this data and look at it once we got into a Postgres database and started building a data viewer in in an early version of Django, and remember really liking the how easy it was to just kind of see things in the admin and how easily it connected to Postgres. It was that was my first experience with it at the time there.
I think that's quite common now, right? With the way data science has come on, this is, you know, these folks who are using pandas or whatever, and then they're like, well, I need to get this online. And, you know, there's a few options, but Django's a good option there, right? You can create an HTML report, you can stick it up, serve it. It's quite simple.
Well, it's not simple, Carlton, though, right? I mean, because a fair number of the people who get my books or who live here in Boston are in that community, right? So at a meetup, they're doing whatever with math and advanced Python, and they're just completely befuddled by the web because they've never done it before. So it's, I often think if there's a way to have like a plug and play for take your data and put it on a Django site with, you know, list view and detail view and login, that would be worth a lot. But the problem is the data is not easily munged together in my experience. Mm. But that's extremely common, at least here in Boston. Whenever I go to meetups or even the Django Boston group, when we were meeting, there were quite a few people who were, you know, scientists and PhDs, and they wanted to know how to display it. And it was, you know, not simple for them.
Yeah, that's true. It's kind of a big jump to go from like a Panda or a Jupyter notebook to Django web app. And, but you can do a lot in those Jupyter notebooks. They're fun, really fun to play with and document what you can do in them.
Yeah. So Tobias, let's, we're talking about college. Can we get your backstory, since I believe the two of you met in college, right?
Yeah, we did. And, you know, before that, we actually, just for clarity, I was not Colin's friend living down the street who he met and had a shareware company with, but we very much later discovered that, that I had also had a small Mac shareware company in high school that wrote applications in Real Basic, which was like a totally bizarre coincidence.
Why weren't you doing why weren't you doing the web? Was the web not as...
I don't know. I think I I was doing some PHP MySQL development as well, but I think Real Basic was the first thing that I was like, for me, C was a little bit over my head, but Real Basic was something that I could understand. And the first application I built when we got a cable modem in junior high, and the you had to have like a login client on your computer to use this thing to enter your username and password, which is like totally foreign to us today. And the client that they had for a Mac was just totally unusable and crashed all the time. But I found somebody had figured out the protocol, posted the details of it online, and was able to write a little login client for that in Real Basic. And The official one was so bad that people actually paid money for it. I think I made a few thousand dollars or something like that in high school. So I was like super proud about that at the time.
That's no bad
and
going.
And just hooked for life, right? You're a high school student, you've got this thing no one understands, you get paid for it. It's like, I'll just do that.
Yeah. So I guess fast forward, I actually took a year off in between high school and college to sort of figure out what I was doing, and got a job writing statistics software. I actually responded to an ad about HTML scripting. Somebody was looking for somebody to do some HTML scripting and responded to that. And pretty quickly, they asked me to go into a programming role instead. That was a lot of fun. I think the one part of that I really enjoyed was they ran their own mail server and on a Mac. And
in a closet
I didn't really know what they were doing with that, so volunteered to set up and ran their mail server for them. And I think that was sort of where my love of managing servers got started, and is, you know, continues today in my work with Cactus and also with the ops team.
So this is all, you know, pre-Gmail, because I think that came on the scene 2004 or something like that. But
yeah,
and that was the first one, as I recall, that was like, well, just use that, right? Before that, everyone had something in their closet for email. Like everyone had some sort of setup. I mean, where I grew up, we're next to a local university, so we tapped into that, but there was no good cloud option. I assume it was around that time when you were doing that, because, you know, today it'd be nuts no to run your own mail server.
Yeah.
but it was common back then. And then there was that interesting overlap where I saw companies even in the 2000s were still running stuff in a closet. And I would go to them and be like, you know, this is crazy, right? Because you've got, but you know, now no one would do that, but I'm sure there's, it, back then it was, very common and the cloud was scary and seemed less safe. Whereas today it's really, you know, the opposite, right?
Yeah, I still do have a soft spot in my heart for PostFix was the mail server that we used at the time, and still have a soft spot for that in my heart. So
then you decided after a year of doing that you wanted to pay to learn how to program instead of getting paid to program?
So I did. I applied to Earlham at that time and got in. I actually shirked the CS department for a couple years there. I had decided that I wanted nothing to do with software and programming. And first, I think I wanted to pursue an acting degree. I eventually settled on philosophy, but it was around the 2 year.
God help you.
Yeah.
Carlton agrees with that.
So, do you have a philosophy degree?
Yeah. Dr. Carlton.
I didn't know.
I do.
I remember when I first, I don't know if James knows this, but when I first discovered the Django community and found James Bennett, I was like absolutely thrilled that he also had a philosophy degree. So, I've never told him that before. But, anyways, I discovered that I really do love programming and sort of joined the CS department as a add-on and specifically sat in on a software engineering class my senior year, and that's how I met Colin and the other two co-founders for Cactus. I think we just really enjoyed working together and writing software as a team. That was all the work I had done previously was individual, and I felt like we were so much more powerful as a team together. And I think it's that mentality that we try to carry through in our work today as well.
Okay. So tell us about Cactus. Cause like, you know, for my entire time in the Django sort of sphere, Cactus is one of those sort of landmark agencies there. But for people listening who perhaps don't know here, tell us about Cactus and how you got started and all of that.
Sure. Yeah, I chuckled when I was listening to your episode with Aaron Mullaney, who is a Cactus alum, and I think the line was something like, Cactus has been around forever. I said, really? Have we been around that long?
No, but, you know, if I had to sit there and think, you know, what are the foundational agencies, you know, the groups that have been there for, you know, for the whole time, Cactus is one of them.
We're really honored to hear that, and it meant a lot to hear that coming from you guys, so... but anyways, we Colin actually moved to North Carolina in 2007 after he graduated from Earlham, and just because it was a central spot for all of us. And I think we tried a few different things at the time. We were doing some PHP development. I think we looked at Rails as well, but settled on Django, I think, because of its affinity for Postgres. And I think this has probably changed now. I don't honestly know, but Rails philosophy at the time seemed to be that your data constraints only needed to exist in the application rather than in the database as well. And we didn't really feel comfortable with that. So I think that's what sort of pushed us over to the Django side.
Do you recall what version of Django this was? Was it pre-1.0 or is it after?
It was 0.96 or 0.97. If those are even things, but no one really used them from what we could tell. Like everyone was following the Subversion, then a Subversion repo, the trunk branch of that, because so much had changed and there wasn't another release. And so it was a really interesting time to get into Django, and like every commit that hit the Subversion trunk branch, like you would need to go and read that and understand what was happening and make changes in your code. So it was an exciting time to be a part of the Django development for sure.
Carlton, that's about when you joined.
That really is the wild west, though, right? Where compared to today, where it's like, you know, the new version, just pip install, it'll be fine. You know, nothing's broken. One deprecation warning. No, I've got to go and read the commit and understand it and rewrite this whole section. Like it's a big different world. I came in about 1.1, I would say. I got a book 1.0, 1.1, something like that.
So the four of you, can I just ask about why do an agency versus a company, or maybe that sort of morphed over time, right? Because you said it was four of you who met in college and then decided to do stuff together.
Yeah. What, like why client services instead of a product company?
Well, I'm just curious the genesis of, yeah, I guess so. I mean, because generally it's some sort of mix of we all like working together and we like technology and we have some ideas, but we can also get paid for client work. And you've all continued, obviously, with client work. So I'm just curious how that path unfolded. I think of a little bit of as actors and musicians, right? Like they all want to be the other. Like every consultant has like a side project or like a passive thing, so they don't have to work with, you know, clients. And on the other hand, everyone who's working at a big company sometimes like, man, I'd like just something new and different. So there's a tension from where I sit in terms of the roles. But disabuse me of that stereotype.
No, that's a good question. I mean, I don't know if it's a question anyone has ever asked us before. I don't know that it was particularly, at least on my part, it was particularly thoughtful or intentional decision. I think it was probably largely naivete at the time and like, oh, we can totally do this. And, you know, I think in retrospect, we had no idea what we were doing. And a lot of it was, you know, timing and just, you know, being a part of the Django community when it was so small, I think certainly gave us a leg up during that time.
Yeah, I think that's what Peter from Lincoln Loop was saying, a similar thing in terms of he very deliberately chose Django over Rails, in part because Django was a little bit newer. So there was less, you know, places that needed Django needed help.
Right.
And, you know, keep riding that wave in a way. And also Python's great, right? Like Ruby's pretty, but Python is clearly won out as the more useful language of the two, I would say.
Okay, I'm not just going to sit there in silence for that one, because like the standard niching down, like pick your niche, focus on it. If you can be a Django specialist, then you're always going to have a market. Like you can be a Fortran specialist, you're always going to get work. You can, you know, I saw something the other day, people moaning about not being able to hire Objective-C developers anymore because everyone's learning Swift. So if you know Objective-C, you've got, you know, you've got a job for life. And Adam Johnson was saying to me yesterday about Amazon IAM. You know, if you can work your way around IAM, you've got a job, right? It's the same. If you,
right.
If you know Django.
But at least there was a desire among all four of you to sort of carve your own path, because today or in the last 5-10 years, I've seen a lot of, especially when I was trying to hire at a startup in San Francisco, someone who comes out of a school with a computer science degree has a lot of offers, like good offers. And so the opportunity cost of going to do your own thing is pretty high. So I wonder, maybe it's the previous work experience you both had, but turning that down takes a lot of guts. Because I recall when I interviewed people, if they were flirting with Google or Facebook or whatever, they weren't going to go to a startup. They needed to know that they wanted a startup. And then if they did want to do a startup, well, then I could, you know, make a good pitch for it. But I couldn't solve that problem for them of like, well, all this, you know, prestige and money and my parents will like it. Like I couldn't fight against that one.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I guess reflecting on that, I think we felt we were doing incredibly well for ourselves at the time. Like my job before college, I think I was making less than $20 an hour doing software development. And then, you know, we start Cactus and, you know, 2007, we're charging, you know, $65 an hour US for this work. And this is, you know, I think by the standard of what was being charged at the time, it was probably quite low. But we were absolutely thrilled with it from my perspective. So
yeah, as a youngster,
that being said, I think it was pretty touch and go there for a while. Colin actually told me just yesterday that he applied to be a baker at the time. I didn't know this, but I'm really glad I didn't go anywhere.
That's my retirement goal too. King Arthur Flour is actually in my hometown. And every time I go up there, I'm like, you know, it's like I could do that. Wake up early and you're just done. And it doesn't need an update.
It's very different than programming. It's kind of a nice change of
pace. Yeah, it's like woodworking, all these like analog hobbies of programmers. I think it's probably a good thing.
Yeah, yeah.
In my case, I just have kids, so that removes the need for hobbies.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe in 20 years.
You have
years.
Hobbies when they leave home. When they're at college, you can have a hobby. So, okay, so you've been running an agency for, you know, 15 years, yeah. What advice would you give to someone starting out down that road? Because it's, you know, a lot of it is the business side about, you know, client development and business development, making sure you know, when one project ends that there's another one there. And what kind of would you say on that? Could you say it was a bit difficult, touch and go at one point?
Yeah, I think my answer to that today is to hire a chief of staff. There are a lot of different people out there in the world who will tell you, you need this or you need that, or you need to, you know, figure out your strategy for this. But I think for us, one of the things that has allowed Cactus to continue is just being able to adapt. And it wasn't until last year, actually, that we made this leap and hired a chief of staff. But just for a company that is as small as we are, being able to adapt to the changing times is really, really critical. So that's been a role that Kel Hanna is our chief of staff. Nod to Kel. Really happy to be working with her, and it's probably what I would recommend as the first thing to anybody sort of embarking on building a small team like this, bootstrapping a small team like this.
Okay, and what does a chief of staff do? Because
Cactus now too, just in terms of size?
Sure, we're 18 full-time employees, and we have a handful of contractors, maybe four or five contractors as well.
That's quite big.
So yeah, decent sized team. We're organized into four different teams within the company right now. Three of those focus on client work. One, you know, just helps keep the business humming. And I think should probably have Kel on to answer that question, because I think the answer is anything and everything. But just, you know, supporting, I think, the organization to find its, maybe it sounds cheesy, but to find its true self and enable the people within the organization to find what brings them joy and do that work.
Well, I mean, because it's super entrepreneurial. I mean, you love to code, so you do an agency, and then you find yourself doing kind of everything but coding at some point along the way. And so figuring out how to, you know, get back to what you want to do and think you're good at, I'm sure it can be a challenge. But actually, related to that, one thing I wanted to ask is, I've always had a sense of Cactus has a reputation of really mentoring and leveling up developers, you know, people who come in maybe at a junior level and are really Aaron and others who are able to make that transition. So I just wanted to ask about how you manage that, because that's a wonderful thing. I know it's not an easy thing, but it leads to people from different backgrounds. And I don't see a lot of companies or even agencies investing in their people in the way that I've seen Cactus.
Oh, thank you, Will. I should probably let Colin talk about that as our CTO, but I think it was an intentional choice on our part, in part because, you know, we maybe had no choice. Like we did want to grow, and very senior developers expect, rightfully so, expect a lot of money. And so this is like you said, a unique way that we've found to, give back and, you know, try to, you know, grow team members, hire team members at a more junior level and provide an opportunity for them to grow within Cactus. And hopefully they'll stay, but if not, like Aaron, that's totally okay too. And we're, delighted to see what the Cactus alumni go off to do in the world after Cactus too. Anything you would add to that, Colin?
I think that we, you know, finding a good fit at the company is always something we're looking for. And for junior folks, we got lucky. We'd find a lot of folks who were just really excited to work with us, and we were excited to work with them. And it would turn into a great kind of relationship that we would grow together, because we were learning a lot too at the time. And how do we grow the company as well as, you know, helping people in, with their skills and experience too. So it's, yeah, I enjoy it. I mean, I think part of the fun for it too is just to be working side by side with somebody and learning from each other. So whether it's you're at a similar skill set, Toby and I like to do a lot of pair programming together, but also if different skill sets, I think can go a long way of what you can learn from each other and pick up when you have the time to pair and work together.
Well, I think that culture is so important because that's not, you don't take that for granted, right? That you clearly do have to have a deep sense of mentorship, enjoying it to do it, as opposed to, right, like the Guilfoyle types, right, in Silicon Valley. Like, I've worked with people like that. You know, if anything, I would say that's more common than wanting to pair program with a junior developer. So it's, I think it's a great thing, but it's some mix of the business from the top deciding it's important and also the type of people you have who find satisfaction in it, as opposed to feeling like they're being held back.
Yeah. When you can work with somebody and I don't know, I think as doing development, you get a lot of these easy wins and you can kind of get excited by, oh, wow, look at that. It's working. I feed off that kind of energy. Like when they get excited, I get excited and I like to just be a part of that sort of loop and that cycle of excitement.
Well, because coding is so intimate in a way. It's so, sort of like this hive mind. Like I struggle to find another analogy in terms of a white collar profession that is so intimately tied together. I mean, it's really, you really get to know someone and how they think. And also you get to see how someone, you know, a couple years before was thinking at the time, you know, you have an understanding of the people or the team.
Or that, not. You know, or what not. Are they thinking?
Well, and then I look at my own code from a year ago and like, man, that guy's terrible. So,
yeah.
But it does. It's, I like that. I like that intimacy of knowing people and seeing how different people approach the same problem, which I think is less, less common in other fields where there's, you know, sort of an agreed upon way to do things, hopefully, in programming sort of, you know, free for all in a way. Right. I mean, that's,
yeah. And I think it's, yeah, part of it's for me is sort of tearing down the curtain too of, you know, what is this mysterious software development thing? And in many ways it's can be chaotic and disorganized and, you know, our CS professor at Earlham, you know, like to joke that it's, you know, it's just honing your Google skills to, you know, figure out what is the best question to Google and going off and Googling that and finding a skeleton that you can carve out and sort of hop inside. And so sort of tearing down the mystery of that and that it, you know, it is a very sort of slow, arduous process at times, I think is, I hope, you know, something that we can communicate through pair programming with folks on our team.
Yeah, I think that's important for juniors to see that it is really slow because you so many, I don't know, blog posts and things in the tech media about rapid development and, you know, getting things done quickly. And it's like, but I don't know about you, but it takes me ages to write software, you know, it really, and a lot of it is, you know, I've got to transform this string. Well, that, you know, that it's a 4 or 5 step procedure that's difficult to get right, and you've got to write tests, and well, it took you all morning to do this really trivial thing, but okay, but that now works, and now I've got that block that I can build on, and that took me, you know, all afternoon to build that, but the next day I've got two blocks and they're together, and okay, and I think people have kind of unrealistic expectations about how quickly it's possible to write software.
Yeah, I get bugged by that too, and the, you know, in the media, oh, someone over a weekend, you know, threw together something or other. It's like, well, maybe, but they kind of just copy and pasted something that they spent 5 years in another capacity building, and then, you know, voila, it works. So we tried it when we have few founders on, you know, to really push them on, like, okay, you built something in a weekend. I remember we had the Listen Notes fellow on, who really impressive company, and he threw together a search engine for podcasts in a weekend, and we really pushed him on, like, well, how did you do that with Elasticsearch? It's like, oh, well, my day job, I'd spent years on it and I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And it's like, oh, okay. You know, cause I do want to, as you say, pull back the curtain and show what does it mean to throw something together over a weekend? It's like, it's basically copy and paste. I mean, it's based on years of experience. And then anything new, it's like, oh, it all stops and the gears start to grind. It's like, uh-oh.
Yeah, yeah.
Cutting back to Cactus and clients then, how do you communicate that difficulty to clients? You know, because, and when you're talking budget with clients, it's always this tricky question is they want, you know, they want to spend a small amount and get quite a lot. And you're like, well, but it's going to take a lot. I mean, how do you deal with that negotiation then?
That's the chief of staff, Carlton. Not their problem anymore.
Yeah, we just turn up and code it.
No, yeah, that's a great question, and I think Colin and I both really love interfacing with clients on that, and trying to, you know, just break down the complexity, as it were, of the work that we do, and really the challenge of getting any sort of concrete estimate for a software project. I mean, it doesn't. Yeah, estimation is one thing that's for me at least has not gotten easier with time. Like it's always been a challenge, and can throw some numbers at the wall, and they're usually wrong. But I think I've just sort of accepted that and can move on. Yeah. So I think we when speaking with clients now, we really try to focus on and understand what the business priorities are. A key part of that for us is in the past few years, especially, has been involving user experience experts in that process. So trying to get at, you know, what is it that the customer really needs to solve this problem, and not necessarily what it is that they're telling us, because sometimes those things can, sometimes they're the same, sometimes those things are different, and can take a little bit of teasing out to figure out what those things are. I think part of that too is just, sometimes understanding the customer's business domain. If it's a business that we're not familiar with, there's a whole lot of knowledge that our customers have that we don't. And just having a methodical process for breaking that down and understanding it, I think has a side effect of, showing how complex the work is that we do, and sort of getting them on board with the process if they do come from a less technical background.
And so it strikes me that there's a large discovery phase there.
Not necessarily large, but I would say we, more often than not, we'd like to spend, what would you say, Colin? At least 2 weeks, possibly 4 or more, depending on the size of the project, before we get started to answer some of those questions and set the team on a good foundation going into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it's going to be important to set the expectations of that.
How do you mean?
To set the expectations of the client, that there is this initial phase, which is discovery and,
Yeah. Yeah. And some clients love that. It is certainly a harder sell for some, but I think once we get into it, the time definitely proves itself.
Sorry, Colin, you were going to say.
I agreed with all that. Just that initial time when you're first becoming acquainted with the project and with the clients, having that discovery process to kind of figure out the requirements together, because no one really knows what they are until we kind of all get in a room with the technical knowledge combined with their knowledge, and we can kind of put the main goals ahead of us and think about those. And it helps with prioritization as well. You can have, through some conversations, figure out, well, what are we really aiming for in this, the first couple versions or the initial release? What are the highest priority items to focus on? Because that can help kind of limit what you're trying to build and not let scope get too big to cause the project to get a little, too expensive.
That's good to have in the back pocket as well, a few weeks into the project when, the requirements start to change a bit and you're like, hey, but you did say priority was this. Is that still the case? And they're like, oh yeah, that's still the case. And you're like, okay then.
Yeah, and it's good to check in because maybe things would change and you kind of have to like swap things out. But overall, I think when everybody takes part in that discovery process together, you do have a shared vision. And I think that really helps keep everybody kind of on the right track together in the end, which is nice.
So I can't think of an elegant segue, but I want to ask about the ops team for the Django Software Foundation.
Sure.
So let's shed some light on this, right? So we just interviewed E. Durbin, who runs infrastructure for Python. And Django has its own ops needs around Django project and other things. So Tobias, you're on that team. Could you just talk about, maybe call out who else is on that team and what that role entails? Because it's a volunteer role, but a pretty important one within the Django community.
Yeah, so it is a small team, small volunteer team. Marius, and I guess Marius is also a fellow, but Florian is the other member of the ops team, and they predate me on the team, and I think have their hands in probably more things and take credit for more things than I can really claim. I joined in 2016. Just as a, you know, as I mentioned earlier on, always have enjoyed tinkering with servers, and this was a way that I could do something that I love and hopefully give something small back to the Django community as well. And so the ops team maintains the servers for DjangoProject.com and all the related sites like the docs site, Django people, things like that. I think the bigger lift is probably maintaining the CI infrastructure. There's a whole bunch of servers that power the custom Jenkins configuration that, you know, every time there's a commit or pull request on Django, runs tests on every possible configuration of, you know, Python and Django and database to make sure that nothing is broken. So that's a big lift. Certainly, I thankfully don't have to worry too much about that because I think Marcus and Florian handle most of that. One thing that I think I was particularly proud of was setting up the CDN for the docs, Django docs site. So wasn't my idea, someone just emailed the Django developers listserv and said, hey, over here in Australia, or I don't remember exactly where it was, the Django docs site takes a really long time to load. Is there anything that we can do about that? Because at the time it was hosted on a single server at Rackspace in the US East region, and it takes a couple seconds for light to travel halfway around the world. So I set up a Fastly, call out to Fastly, donated a CDN to the Django Software Foundation, and we set that up in front of the doc site, and more recently some others as well, static and media sites.
E mentioned that Fastly also donates to the Python Software Foundation, which has a little bit more traffic than we do, and it makes a huge difference, obviously, in terms of speeding things up.
Yeah, and it's really fun to watch the statistics, the live statistics dashboard that they have with the traffic popping up all over the world of where requests are coming from to hit the Django docs site at any given point in time.
Yeah, I mean, the Django docs site does get some real traffic.
I mean, it's kind of non-trivial as well, because there's all of the supported versions, all of the unsupported versions are still there as well. There's each of the translations for, I think there's 8 versions of 3.2 that are up, and, it's non-trivial to get them built, to get them up and to serve them. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. And I hope that it's working. We tried to instrument something to invalidate the cached pages every time a commit happens, so that especially when a new security release comes out, that you can actually see that page right away and you don't see the stub that was there ahead of time, because that would be particularly frustrating and off-putting, I think, for the community if there's a new security release but nobody can see what's in the release notes for that. So hopefully that is working.
So you're trying to just refresh the changes, as opposed to just when there's a new commit rerunning the whole cache?
I think it does just invalidate the whole cache. I don't actually recall. It was a few years ago, so I don't recall exactly what it does. But I think it either invalidates the whole cache, or just for that version of the Django docs, it will invalidate that stem in the URL.
Because I'm just curious, because for smaller sites, certainly it's easy just to invalidate everything. And there is an option. I mean, on my smaller sites, I use Cloudflare, and sometimes I'm like, well, should I just change the section I just changed, or do it all? And at the end of the day, it's like, it only takes one hit to warm it up.
Yeah.
But that whole process of warming up the cache, I always wonder, when does that really, really matter? I almost think that maybe it doesn't matter as much these days as it used to, but it's a cool concept of, you know, preloading the cache and running a script to set all that up. It's sort of like fun to do, but I wonder if it's, you know, I wonder if I should be doing that on my own sites versus like right now it's kind of manual because I'm a little bit lazy about it.
Yeah, I don't think we added anything to sort of pre-warm the cache after flushing it like that. So there will be a period of time after, you know, the cache is invalidated where you can see the, I think it hovers around 60% hit ratio for the Django doc site. The static media is much higher, like a, you know, 100%, like, because those files never change. But I think it hovers around 60, 65% for the doc site. And it pretty quickly returns to that if you, you know, once it's invalidated. So yeah, I didn't bother with that for this.
Oh, I mean, that's it. I mean, you know, I'm on the emails, but it's still a little bit of a mystery to me what the ops team really does right. as well. So sure. I just wanted to shed light on it because I know there's all of you who work on it and it's sort of, you know, as long as it's working until there's right. a problem. And then yeah. So wait, who's in charge of that?
Yeah. And speaking of sort of, and I think it's turned into less of an emergency, but yeah, much less of an emergency, but a year so you're a little over a year ago, I think it was, when Rackspace announced that they were offboarding a lot of their free open source projects. We sort of had a mad scramble mm-hmm. to find hosting providers for that. This was just pre-pandemic, I think. Maybe I'm misremembering, and that was 2 years ago.
No, it's about
last year's all blurred together.
No, I remember it well. Yeah, there was because I think as part of that, there was those emails about it. And I remember thinking like, no, that can't, like, there must be someone at Rackspace who feels strongly about Django. And I think I tweeted out and we sorted it out. So they were very generous again, but.
So we should call, out the, you know, the people who provide the, some of the resources, right? Because it's non-trivial.
Yeah. But yeah, they're in the footer of the website, but yes, Rackspace, Fastly, I guess there's also now there's the Oregon Computing Group, right?
It's part of this mad scramble to figure out if we are losing Rackspace or not. I think we ended up with far more hosting than we probably need. I think probably over 70, maybe close to $100,000 worth of free hosting provided annually to the Django Software Foundation from Sys11, which I think is a German company, the Oregon State University open source lab, which, yeah, I had a very small open source project there many, many years ago, a couple decades ago, and they were able to donate, roughly equal to what Rackspace was providing previously. And then AWS as well, they recently started an open source free hosting for open source projects program. So Rackspace, AWS, Sys11, and OSU, OSL, I think are now all hosting providers, as well as Fastly to the DSF.
And the biggest thing?
I think we have something on Heroku. I think we pay
also Heroku
a little bit. I forget. Which area
I think
is Heroku?
I think it might be the Django People site.
Well, the Django
I could
Snippets.
Be wrong
about
we
that. Shut down. We sunset Django People last year, but it's Django Snippets that's still run on Heroku.
Snippets. Okay. Thanks, Carlton. Yeah.
Snippets. Well, and there was also Django Packages is not part of Django formally, and that just transferred over from Daniel and Audrey were running that with some volunteers, and Jeff Triplett from RevSys has taken over the hosting of that. Which is hosted on DigitalOcean. So we're just covering everything with all the platforms.
Good. And can I just ask, the biggest thing is the docs, right? That's the biggest bandwidth hog.
It's got to be the most visited site. I think the static media is probably the most, or the downloads, Django downloads is probably the most bandwidth. Just that I think the HTML probably pales in comparison to the size of all the HTML and all the images and JavaScript that CSS that need to be downloaded. Certainly the docs site is probably gets the most traffic. So.
Well, on the board, we get the emails that come in through the contact form, and there's always amusing, you know, generic ones being like, "Hey, we see your site has some traffic, we'd like to put ads, or we'd like to do a sponsored post," you know, they're just spamming the web and it's interesting to see like, oh, like you've got some traffic on this site. Like, it's like, yeah, we do. you clearly don't know anything about, you know, you hopefully you have some bot and not some person sending these emails, but they're well. Pretty amusing to see. I know we've gone a little on time. I really want to ask about projects. So you both, like, there's a whole list in our docs here of some really cool projects that Cactus has worked on. I'd love to hear about some of them and how they shook out, right? Part of this podcast is to talk about Django in the wild and actually being used. So what comes to mind for either of you of cool projects with Django?
I think, you know, for me, we've worked on so many projects over the years. I think for me, I usually think back to the first project that we did with UNICEF in 2010, in part because it was an incredibly fun and exciting project to work on, in part because I think it also, maybe precipitated some of Cactus's growth. We'd applied to this project to travel to Zambia and Malawi and build a Django-backed SMS application to deliver infant HIV test results from the lab. So there's only one PCR lab at the time. There was only one PCR lab in Zambia that could do the test for infant HIV test result. And then they would, take the results on paper on a motorbike and take them back to, you know, the rural health clinics that were serving these families. And so we were able to cut the time in half for delivery of those HIV test results by sending them by text message, because there's, you know, mobile connectivity all over the country. Send them back by text message to the provider, who would then, you know, follow up with the patient if there was a positive result. That was one. And I think we won that and we're like, oh my gosh, we have this other contract that we also need to serve. And so that sort of precipitated some of our initial hires at Cactus as well. So that's probably the one I think of. Colin, what's a project for you?
It's a good question. I was looking at these here. I think I one that I actually got to work on recently was related to, it started as a volunteer project of mine. I befriended an attorney in the area who knew about this data set at the state that basically there's a statute in North Carolina that all police agencies need to record their data and send it to the state DOJ so that they, and it's recorded and stored centrally in this large database that no one had really looked at, because at this point it has, you know, 22 plus years of data in it, and most folks who would try to use it just didn't know how to work with that large of a data set. And what started as a volunteer project to build this website called Open Data Policing and See eventually became a Cactus project later on, and when we tried to expand it into other states that had somewhat similar statutes, but not as good. North Carolina actually has a fairly good one overall. But overall, I mean, the site itself is what I like about it is that it's local to us, so it's in the North Carolina area, but it also helps you visualize and see what your local police department or department in the area, what your the stops look like, and what led to a search, and kind of there's a form that a police officer fills out that has some demographic information on it, so you can slice the data based on like race and ethnicity to see if there are some disparities in how the departments are operating. And we just relaunched that as NC Cop Watch with another organization here in North Carolina. And I think it's a great project to be a part of, and how we can kind of help shed some light into the policing around our area and what we can do to help there.
Yeah, that kind of thing is awesome. That reminded me of when we had Jose Padilla on. He was doing a similar thing in Puerto Rico about government expenses, that they're all sort of available, but they weren't available. So by putting them on a website and then shining a light on them, they were able to, you know, hopefully improve behavior over time, right? Because visibility is the greatest disinfectant.
Yeah. Well, and this, of course, Simon Willison is, his project data set is trying to make this more off the shelf for journalists and other people. I'm looking at the site. So How do you do search, if you recall, on the like open data policing? Because you've got a search bar there, you've got tens of millions of records. Do you recall how you are? I'm partial to search. I mean, I did a talk on it and I find it a really interesting topic.
Yeah. You mean the find a stop feature? Is that the part you're looking at?
Well, so on open data policing, like on North Carolina, there's a way to view agency dashboard. You can search, or I guess any of it, right? I assume you're using the same type of search. Like, is it
That's true.
Postgres search? Is it, you know, Elasticsearch or something?
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
How?
Yeah. It's all Postgres behind the scenes. The search is, there are a lot of stops. I think there are like 22 million stops, and when you join that with the searches, it can get expensive. But by far, the largest data set is the State Highway Patrol. That they make over 60%, I think, of all the stops and searches in the state. And so anything you kind of do with that agency, it's a little more expensive than the others. But yeah, I think it's all just Postgres and just some tuning to get it to respond quickly, and it works pretty quickly. And the idea is that, like, you could get stopped by the State Highway Patrol, and the agency has basically 60 days to report that to the DOJ. But eventually your stop would show up there and you could look at it. And then the officer ID is not like their badge number, so it doesn't actually identify who the officer is, but it is a unique number tied to that officer. So you could actually then look and see what their, you know, stop history looks like and get a sense of who have they stopped before as well.
Yeah, that would be, I mean, that's one of the things I've read about the Derek Chauvin trial going on right now, is that they're able to talk about the back history of Floyd, but not of the police officer. In court, they're not allowed to mention his history as an individual or as a police officer, even though in North Carolina, at least, that would be readily available.
Yeah, and
so, yeah.
it's an interesting question of jurisprudence, isn't it? It's like, you bring someone to trial, you're bringing them to trial for that particular event, not convicting them on they were a shady character, which, you know, has led to miscarriages of justice in a billion times. I'm not mentioning anything about this particular case, but
yeah,
it's an interesting sort of philosophical problem. Like, what is accessible as evidence in a court of law? Anyway, that's not Django chat. That's, you know.
Well, speaking of other civic things, though, so Code for Durham. Could either of you talk about this this organization?
Yeah. That's a volunteer effort that I'm a part of here, and is part of where Open Data Policing was born. And it started around 2013, and I'd learned about Code for America from other activities that were going on in the area. One was an open data day that was just looking at open data sets that were in the Triangle region of North Carolina, and learn about the idea of brigades, which are just volunteer groups in certain areas that are organized around helping their communities using technology, and has really just kind of grown. I mean, we meet every other week. Used to be in the Cactus office, though. Oh, wow. I haven't been there in a while. And the brigades, I think, can vary a lot from area to area. But in Durham, we do a lot of building apps for Durham, and the policing one was one. We also recently worked on a project that we're partnered with Legal Aid of North Carolina to help with record expungement. And that one was kind of fun because Cactus held an internal kind of pitch competition, and where we could kind of bring a project idea, and Cactus, one of the Cactus teams would work on it for a little bit, and I pitched the idea to help do an improvement to it, and ended up winning. So it was kind of exciting to get a little bit of the Cactus force behind it to help push the project ahead. So it was nice, good help there.
I love that you're doing this, because I feel like sometimes engineers don't know what to work on, but at the same time, people who are interested in code, they have all these very real things they'd like to solve, but they have no idea how any of the pieces come together. So to know that these data sets are available, you can build a site and search them, you know, yeah, that would completely, I'm sure, hook people into like, yeah, I do want to learn how to program. I do want to get over the humps of things because it's powerful and it's, you know, anyone with knowledge can do it.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely motivating for me to, oh, wow, I can really like help this, the community and these attorneys with record expungement. And it's not that complex of a problem, but like once the technology comes into play, it can really help out certain areas.
Well, what, if you know what you're doing, I mean, here, a guest we had two episodes ago, built the COVID tracking for the entire state of Massachusetts in about 8 weeks. And someone I knew, and, you know, I've used that. All my friends have used that. And, you know, it's like, wow, that's Django being used. Same thing. A lot of the vaccine trackers, the open source ones that are out there, are actually also Django in various states where you can, you know, compile which pharmacies and which hospitals have stuff. So, it's programming is a superpower, right? If you know what you're doing. I did actually, so I know we're coming up on time. One thing I wanted to ask the two of you, because you do work with junior developers. So the command line, how do you introduce this to people? Like, I know this sounds like a non sequitur, but like everyone has to learn how to use it, but nobody, it's completely befuddling to people. And then there's like WSL on Windows. I wonder if when you have a junior developer, like how do you explain that elegantly? Because this is something I'm struggling with, right? Like we all use the command line, we need to use it. And you kind of use the same commands, but getting to that point, like the first time you go text only is super scary for people. And it's I feel like it's this like switcheroo where it's like, I want to use Python. It's like, well, first you gotta learn the command line and da 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 da, and don't type these commands because that'll nuke your computer. and then you can come around to Python and all the rest. So I just, from a personal standpoint, ask if you've had any inspiration on like, what is this, you know, scary thing that is, a, you know, we use all the time, but we don't think twice about it, right? It's like, I use the same five commands and anything else I look up, but it's taken me a while to get to that point, right? Mm-hmm. You gotta learn what the file system is. And so I'm just curious, as you level up developers, this must be part of that process, is working with the command line.
Yeah, honestly, I think the, I want to see what Colin thinks too, but I think the Django Girls tutorial does a wonderful job of that, introducing the command line and talking through that. So many years ago, we actually had our own Django boot camp that we put together the material for.
Yeah, I saw that,
It's a huge amount of effort to maintain, and have found that is much easier to do with the force of the entire world behind it, you know, behind a tutorial like Django Girls or something else. So often point people to that, you know, whether internal or outside of Cactus, point people to that as a starting point for Python, Django, and the command line. Anything else? It's maybe a bit of a cop-out. Anything else?
Well, no, I don't think so. But I mean, even that one, and I was just looking at Codecademy, like, you know, because on a Mac, it switched over to ZSH by default. And so the prompt is different. It's the percentages instead of a dollar sign. So like, just how do you explain to someone? It's like, well, okay, you're on a Mac. Okay, what type of Mac? What's your operating system? Okay, the prompt may look like this. It may look like that. Don't worry about everything to the left of it. You know, what's terminal? That's different than shell. That's different than console. You know, there's hyper and iterm in terminal. It's just like, you know, oh, and the commands are different on Windows, and so is the file system. And by the way, there is a file system. You know, it's just like, I feel like it's me being that engineer I hate, who's just like, oh, you want a simple answer? Let me go on an hour digression. but you do need to know those things, right? So it's like, how do you, the Django Girls tutorial is really good, even though it still uses the bash prompt. Sorry, Colin, you're going to say, I'm just venting because I'm just like, been thinking about this a couple of days. I'm just like, God, programming sometimes, you know, with all the powers, it's just like, there's still these things where I'm like, I don't want to be that person who just completely bombs someone with information who wants to just get started.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I have much. I do feel like when I have paired with someone who is learning that type of, even just the command line or interacting with Git, I do think it's,
yeah,
really,
I'll
valuable
get to, yeah,
to,
for sure,
to do, to like start at the like the CLI rather than the GUI versions, because I think it's easy to kind of jump into the GUI if you're new to the command line and using one of those, you know, source tree or some of the tools out there. But I think it's just more of like a hesitancy to jump in. If you're like pairing with someone, you can walk through and talk about each command, and we have sometimes helped like built out a little like cheat sheet of things to do, like run, you know, run git status for certain things and how to make a new branch. And I think if you can kind of like help get over those first couple of humps, it's easy. It takes away some of the anxiety that you may have jumping into the terminal and the command line for the first time.
Right. And then set up your alias so you can do GS, because git status is just way too long to write. Right. That's my fault. I totally forget what the actual commands are because I have all these shortcuts. So, you know, git commit, GC. And, I get kind of annoyed. I'm like, I got to type this whole thing out. What?
Yeah.
But I guess pair programming would be good because you do need to actually do it. And
yeah, going through
that
motions.
Beginner mindset.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Carlton, I know we're out of time now. I've hijacked the conversation, but I just wanted to ask about the command line, because I think about how to educate people, right? And it's like, if I'm sitting next to someone, that's one thing, but how do I do it in a, you know, verb, in a text or video form where I have to kind of guess all the things that could come up and address them without, you know, swamping someone? And it's just this command line thing. I just occurred to me, like, oh yeah, like the prompt is different, you know? So if you go into a server, it's probably still bash, but you could install ZSH, but, and like, how different are the two of them? And it's like, wait, it doesn't even like really matter. Like, right? Like all you need to do is like CD and LS basically, and then run a script. But getting to that point, you know, not to mention, you know, my path, like I saw that if you install the new, so I run the site installpython3.com and I'm updating it, because that's like a opinionated way to install Python. And it seems like on Mac, you know, Homebrew, you want to use the Python installer. And the Python installer is great, but it automatically adds something to your path. So it'll put it in front. So it's like, do I want to tell someone that happened, or just be like, it probably worked, right? It's like, I don't really want to get into that. And if I'm sitting next to them, it's like, oh, sweet, it worked. But if it doesn't work, now someone has a munged up path, and that's like Google hell, I think, to try to fix someone's path.
Yeah.
Anyways, maybe pair programming is the answer, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the concept of like, changing directory, CD, and moving around within the file system in the shell. Thinking back to pair programming or, you know, tutorials that I've done, that is it's a hard thing to understand, for sure.
Well, that's why we all get the big bucks, right?
You know how to use CD?
Exactly. Yeah.
I can successfully change back out of my home directory.
And what's the home directory? Why does that matter? Yeah. Like, what's tilde symbol? It's like, I didn't know that was called tilde until I was, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyways, is there anything I've missed? I know we have a lot of notes. Any other projects or things either of you wants to call out?
Yeah, I just wanted to call out Karen Tracy. I don't know if you've had her on here before, but she has a...
I don't think so.
She has a fun origin story of how she first heard about Cactus, which I'll let her tell if she's comfortable sharing.
I'd love to have her on, because I got a book of hers where she wrote about debugging and testing with Python, with Django, like, you know, early day, like quite a while ago, but it was, you know, great book.
Yeah. Yeah. And we met Karen back in, I think, 2009, when we had emailed the Django developers listserv about organizing a sprint in the Triangle, and had no idea that there was a Django core developer in the Triangle of North Carolina. And we're absolutely thrilled that she could be there, and that, you know, turned into, obviously, Karen joined Cactus in 2010, and yes, turned into a decade long relationship. So we're happy to have Karen, and just grateful for all of her help at Cactus over the years.
I should check out that book. I didn't know about that book. I know it's Django 1.1, testing and debugging, but I'm sure a lot of it still applies.
No, it all totally still applies. I mean, you know, it's just gold dust, that book. It's great.
So, but yeah, other than that, Colin, anything you had?
No, I don't think so. That was great.
Yeah. Well, Tobias, it's nice to see you in person. I feel like we've sent so many emails back and forth over the last couple of years, but I never actually had met you. So
yeah, nice likewise. To do it. And
you know, digitally, hopefully, you know, we can all meet up at a DjangoCon or event.
Hope so. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. 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 Thank you, Will, for all your help with the hosting related things and the DSF ops collaboration. Colin and I were just talking yesterday about how much we really miss getting together at conferences and things with folks. I was actually just before the pandemic was like one of the nice things about the ops team, which I'll throw in at the end, is that I'm definitely a person who does better in smaller groups. So like meeting Marcus and Florian there has been really great. And yeah, Marcus and I were actually going to share a hotel room at DjangoCon EU. And then of course the pandemic happened. So we're very much looking forward to getting back out there and meeting folks in smaller groups at conferences and you guys as well. So thank you so much for putting this together and inviting us to be on. It's a lot of fun to talk.
Thanks for coming on the show. Really great.
Yeah, thank you both. So we will have links to everything in the show notes. We're at djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter, and we'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.